Herman Skolnick at Dr. Paul W. Morgan's home to interview him for the Palmer History Project of the Center for History of Chemistry. Today is March the 15th, 1986, and the time is just about 10 minutes to 2. Now, Dr. Morgan, you know that, that after this is recorded and transcribed, we will send you a copy of the transcription for your approval and for any changes you wish to make.
Okay.
And of course, we will need your approval too, that for the Center for History Chemistry to retain it as an archive record, and also for the transcription. And I might even, as your friend here said, they might even put into a book form eventually. I hope they do, because I think it's a very, very worthwhile project.
I would think so. Well, I agree with that.
Want to make sure these are moving. Checking the tape to see they are moving. You better check this one too. Yep. Okay, we're on the air. Now, I would like to have first your date of birth.
It's August 30th, 1911.
And where?
In West Chesterfield, New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And, did you live there through your high school?
No. My family moved to Maine when I was seven.
What part of Maine?
Along the coast at Thomaston.
Mm-hmm.
And they went there to work in the shipyards, and that's where my mother had been born. I grew up there at Thomaston, Maine, and went to high school.
What did your father do?
Well, he at that time, in the beginning, he worked in the shipyards. And
What kind of work in the shipyards?
He was a carpenter.
Oh.
He'd been working in sawmills and carpentry work in New Hampshire.
Did you live in towns, or did you live in the villages, or in the farm?
Yeah, it was in a small village of about 2,000 people.
You're a heck like I am.
Yes.
Didn't you think Wilmington is an awfully big town?
Well, it's pretty big, but not as big as town.
It was to me. Well, obviously, then when you went to Columbus, Ohio,
that was a lot bigger.
You really got lost there, didn't you?
Yes.
How about your mother? Was she in any profession or anything?
She had been a school teacher. In fact, they had both been school teachers.
Oh, your father was a school teacher.
Time, yeah.
And before he was a carpenter?
Yes.
He became a carpenter to earn more money, huh?
I guess so. Yeah, he started out, my grandfather, on my father's side, was a minister, a pastor.
What denomination?
I guess it's Universalist. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure
that. That sounds about right for that part of the country.
Yeah.
Especially if you're from Massachusetts, anyway, Boston area.
And my father went 1 year to college at St. Lawrence University in New York, thinking that he might be a minister too, but then he changed his mind.
Yeah, back those days, 1 year of college qualified you to teach in the
Oh, yes. You could teach without even any...
any college at all, yeah.
Background at all. You could.
Did your mother go to any college? Or she
went to Gorham Normal School, yes.
It was a two-year curriculum back then, I guess.
So. Yes.
Just like Westchester used to be until recently.
Right.
Not recently, until about 1930-something.
Yeah.
Okay, so here you have both parents who were immersed in the educational field. Even though your father went into the carpenter business, because he was a carpenter, did he put hammers and saws and screwdrivers in your hand when you were about 4 or 5, 6 years old?
Yes, I got to use tools a lot. And,
so you're a good carpenter too, then?
Yes, I guess I am. I've done a lot of that. I've done a lot of woodworking.
You think that sort of primed the pump for you to go into science? In fact, you were mechanical very, very early in life through your father?
Well, that was one facet of it. Through my father again, and my mother got interested in nature subjects and was active as a collector of minerals and butterflies and things of that sort. Had a little museum that my father helped build.
This was from the time you were a child. I mean, like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old.
In the time of high school times, I was in the Boy Scouts.
Did you become an Eagle Scout?
No, I didn't. My brother did, but I didn't.
How far did you get?
I got up to star.
That was the first step of first class.
I got 29 merit badges, but I wasn't much of an athlete. And
swimming stopped you.
Not swimming, but life saving.
Oh, the life saving stuff. Didn't you have to do some life saving for the first class? Was that just swimming?
You had to do swimming, but you didn't have to do
no life saving.
Right.
Yeah, the merit badge did require quite a bit of skill in life saving. Yeah.
You also had to get another merit badge in physical fitness, which required you to train another boy for 3 months. And the requirements were quite a bit tougher then.
That one I don't remember. Now I was an Eagle All Palm. I don't remember. I was Eagle All Palm. It was one I didn't.
You might have gotten athletics, which was another one.
I was an athlete in high school and college.
Yeah.
Why were you non-athletic? Was it because you were a bookworm, or because you were small and thin and lightweight?
I was a little on the heavy side.
I
was heavier than I am now.
You mean when you graduated high school, you were heavier than you are now?
Yeah. I was up to 160 or something like that.
Hmm. So what are you now, 140?
147.
You're about 6 feet tall, aren't you?
I'm 5 foot 10.
That's a good weight for you. You keep that weight.
Yeah. Yeah, the doctor recommends that.
Yeah.
He doesn't complain.
Now, outside of the nature part, how else did your parents influence you towards science or towards intellectual life?
In many ways, my father, he was a real student. He knew Greek and Latin, and he taught me Latin before I went into high school. We had a unabridged Webster's dictionary, which had been given to him, and we had a microscope. So I got lots of encouragement.
That's terrific for that period of our history.
That period of time, yeah.
I never heard of the microscope until I think college.
Right. So we had those things, and I built a little lab in the barn and bought chemicals to analyze minerals with. And in high school,
this is before you took chemistry in high school. You were analyzing the minerals.
Well, yes, I was making tests for. To identify them.
You can see if they're carbon.
Low pipe analysis and things like that.
Oh, you're actually doing that too, huh?
Yeah.
And you knew about the colors of the flames and the.
Yeah, I am.
For things like chromium and so forth.
Yeah. And in fact, I took a course in mineralogy at the University of Maine, and I probably knew more about mineralogy than the instructor at that time, but I still learned a lot.
I guess your parents rather encouraged you to read a lot, too, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
And what sort of books were they?
Another area that we got into was working puzzles. My father liked to work word puzzles and mathematical puzzles.
You mean like crossword puzzles?
We did some crossword puzzles.
Cryptograms, too.
But we did all kinds of these acrostics and then simple mathematical problems that required algebra and so on. This sort of thing made you search the dictionary for words, so you got a lot of learning that way. My father got interested in radio, and we'd build a crystal set, and later on a one-tube set.
Yeah, that would be in the 1920s, you talk about the crystal set.
These are the first. Yeah. We put up our own area.
You lived in New Hampshire, you lived in Maine then. Could the crystal set bring in the station in Boston?
Yes, we could get Boston, and we could get
KYW,
Pittsburgh,
KYW.
Yeah, those are the strong stations. Yeah, and we got Montreal too.
Oh, that's right. I forget. Yeah, we were close to Montreal. Yes. Yeah.
So,
because this would be on clear days only, though.
Right, at the right time.
What's the right weather?
No,
actually, back in the '20s, you put up a real, real long antenna, didn't you?
Yeah.
Like 100 feet long or so.
That's right, that's what we had. We went up in the woods and got a spruce pole and put an antenna.
Of course, you had to use earphones before the days of loudspeaker. And did you use the Pentamark for your resistor, for your crystal set?
I don't remember that we did, no.
Well, you couldn't buy resistors back then in the early 20s,
whether we had something made out of wire or
I made mine out of a pencil mark.
I see.
You had to experiment a lot until you had the right resistance, of course.
Yeah, okay.
You remember any books you read as you were in junior high school or high school? Was it mostly in the science area? Was it mostly
A lot of them were in the science area. I read quite broadly. I wore the library out. We didn't have much money to buy books.
Even though it didn't cost $1 apiece those days. So.
Yeah. Like one Christmas I got, the only present I got was Gray's Manual of Botany.
Oh boy.
But that was way beyond my ability to understand.
Well, wouldn't have to be more memory than understanding.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And that's just not the earmark of the medical profession, memorization rather than understanding.
That helps. But we did have bird books, and I borrowed books from the library on electricity and mineralogy. And
did you experiment with electrical things too?
Oh, yeah. Played with simple things.
You didn't rewire your house or anything like that, did you?
No, we didn't have any electrical. We had kerosene lamps.
Oh.
But we had electrical circuits out in the barn, which were made up of scrap. We used to go to the dump, dump, and collect old wire and batteries from automobiles.
Oh, so you generate your own electricity?
Yeah.
And it was all DC. Was it all DC, or did you?
Well, we had
you put up a generator.
The magnetos out of Ford automobiles and things like that. Which would be. And
so
the telephone company dumped stuff on the dump too, and we picked that up. So we got little light bulbs and sockets and all kinds of stuff.
Hmm.
It was fun to play with.
When you went to high school, you took biology first and then chemistry and physics, I assume.
They didn't have any biology. They had 1 year in chemistry and 1 year in physics.
And chemistry was first. Physics was first back those days, I think, wasn't it?
I think.
Yeah, physics was first.
Well, it was in alternate years, so they didn't. So. I think I took chemistry first, and then physics after. And there was a school of about 300-400 students.
This is the high school you're talking about?
This is the high school,
and a total of 300 students in that high school.
Yeah, there were about 300 students in the whole high school.
So there were about 75 in your graduating class then, huh?
Well, it didn't get that big. It was, maybe I'm exaggerating the size of the school. It's freshman, I must be. The freshman class started at 36 when I was in it, and it ended up at 19. So
you're 19 in graduating class, then.
Yeah.
Oh.
So the school must have been only 100 Yeah, it's about half what I'm saying. 150, probably.
What was your position when you graduated? Were you valedictorian?
I was valedictorian. I was going to bet on that. Well, I was going to tell you one other thing. Because they didn't have enough chemical supplies, a lot of the experiments were done by demonstration. And another fellow and I were lucky to get the privilege of preparing the experiments and doing the demonstration.
Hmm.
And so I got extra experience that way.
So actually, who influenced who most? You, the teacher, or the teacher, you, in high school?
Yeah.
Was the teacher capable of teaching chemistry?
Well, at least the simple stuff.
He was not well educated in chemistry.
The teacher, I think he knew it, but he was the principal of the school, actually, and he was teaching math and science, and athletics. So he was doing all of these things.
Well, what part of athletics? You mean like football, soccer?
Yeah, he was the coach for all sports, everything. Oh. The women's and boys' teams, and
but the girls don't
want baseball.
Only thing the girls had was the field hockey, I guess, wasn't it? Then?
Well, they had the girls had basketball. Oh. I don't think we didn't have any field hockey.
Oh.
We didn't have any swimming either because there was no swimming pool. Mostly it was baseball and basketball.
And track a bit.
And, yeah.
Were you on the track team?
I didn't go out to this side of the thing. I was a manager of the baseball team 1 year. And,
what year was
that's
that?
About the extent of my athletic.
Was that your freshman year, your junior year, or your senior year?
That was my senior year.
No. And I suspected you were drafted for that job, huh?
Yes, pretty much.
Did you have a school paper?
They had class paper,
for the seniors.
Publication. But they didn't have a weekly paper or anything, or a monthly paper or anything like that.
No, for the class paper, did you do writing for that?
Some, yes. I wrote some horrible fiction and
that sort of stuff.
Kind of stuff like that. Others did the reporting kind of thing.
And how about you have brothers or sisters?
I had one brother. He became a chemist too.
Is he older or younger than you?
He's 2 years younger.
So you influenced him evidently towards chemistry.
I think so. He was an athlete and he was on the baseball team and he became an Eagle Scout. So he was rather different in some ways than I, but we were very good friends and got along well.
Now, he did not go to DuPont, though, as a chemist. What happened to him as a chemist?
He got his BS with me at the University of Maine, and then he later got an MS at Brooklyn Polytech. And he had gone to work for American Cyanamid as a chemist.
At Stanford, not at Brownford.
Yeah. And he was there for 15 years, and then later became chief chemist for a plant that the Inmont, in National, well, it became Inmont.
And that's
anyway.
Inmont.
Inmont. Yeah. Wow. They had a fabric coating plant up in Winthrop, Maine, and he transferred up there as a chief chemist.
So he really ended up as a development chemist, really.
Yeah,
almost like an engineer. Right?
Yes, he did that, and he traveled. He was sort of tech service, and traveled around as sort of salesman, tech service, and chief chemist at the plant. And,
he could do everything, huh?
Yeah,
he did everything except research, huh? He did some of that too, I guess.
Well, he did research at Cyanamid, but he didn't.
Has he published anything?
He had several publications, and he had about a dozen patents. He died a year or so ago, a couple years ago. It's one of those unfortunate things that he got exposed to the chemicals before OSHA
and EPA.
Yeah, and EPA. So that he got liver damage from things like tetrahydrofuran, methyl ethyl ketone, and vinyl chloride, and all those horrible things that they allowed to get out into the plants.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know science was your favorite subject in high school. Were there other favorite subjects in high school? What did you enjoy?
Well, I enjoyed school in general.
Everything you took, you enjoyed.
Yes, I enjoyed the English. I had 3 years of French, which I enjoyed. Never really got expert, but...
Well, you were expert reading French, but not talking French.
Yes, that's right, mostly.
That's true for most of us chemists.
Yeah, I think that's generally true of chemists, unless they get to go abroad.
It never helped me any going abroad.
No, it didn't.
I still speak it, but not the way French like to hear it.
No, that's true. I've always had that trouble, too.
My worst experience was always in Quebec City.
Mm.
They speak a different French than the French do in France.
Sure. And sometimes the French don't want to talk to you either, and they purposely make it difficult.
And did you study German in high school or college?
I did that in college.
2 years?
I had two years and a half. I guess I had 2 years of regular German and a half year of technical German. And again, I mostly reading type. And although I joined a German club that put on little plays and things like that. Not especially good at it.
So actually there was nothing in school that you disliked then except athletics.
I guess so. I don't know that I disliked athletics other than that I wasn't interested in it. I suppose that because in the scouts I was doing lots of hiking and bicycle riding, took long trips, camping, things of that sort.
So you passed the camping merit badge, huh?
Oh, yes. Right.
50 nights camping. Yeah.
50 nights of camping. I did the hiking merit badge, which required 3 months of walking. So
now, why did you choose University of Maine for your undergraduate work?
Well,
was that influenced by your teachers at the high school?
No, that has a little bit of a roundabout story. As I've said, we didn't have much money, and there was a scholarship available in the town to go to Harvard, which was about $900, I think it was. And it was supposed to pay your tuition plus other a contribution to some other expenses.
But having two room and board, too. $900 back then.
Oh, that was a lot of money.
It was tuition, room and board, yes.
It was several hundred dollars for tuition, I think.
But then the clothes is on you, and also travel expenses is on you.
Yeah.
That been very expensive. In the
But I had relatives up in Massachusetts, which was in help. But I didn't... I applied for this, and got approval with the exception that I had to share it with one other student who was already at Harvard.
Oh, that would have been $450.
That meant cutting it in half.
That would have been very expensive for you, yes.
Yeah, so I couldn't manage. And
now your scholarship in Maine, did that include tuition or tuition, room and board?
At Maine, I didn't have any...
It was a state university under the land grant.
Yes, that's right. And tuition was quite low.
Well, still must have cost you between $400 and $500 a year, though.
I eventually went there, and I chose chemistry as curriculum, and it cost me about Well, an average of $500 a year to actually go to Maine for 4 years. In fact, it ended up a little less than that because of a number of things. The first year I stayed in the dormitory. The second year I boarded myself with another student in a small cabin where we did our own cooking and washing and all that. And then I stayed out 2 years. Well, I should say, after high school, I stayed out 1 year, too, and worked.
So you accumulated some money that 1 year?
Yeah, so I was collecting money.
And what was the highest salary you earned that year? $25 a week? $15 a week?
Oh, I didn't even get that. I was getting $10, $12 a week.
Well, $25 back then was very, very high wages. Yes, I know. You and I are within 2 years of each other. You're 2 years older than I am. No, 3 years. You're 3 years older than I am.
So I managed to save up enough money to get through those first 2 years. And then my brother and I had agreed that we would, he was 2 years behind me, we would work 2 years and support the other. I would stay out 2 years and support him, which I did. Make contributions for his going to school. And then by the end of that year, his second year, my mother died in that period. And she had had a little bit of money.
This would be what, about 1930, 1933?
Yeah, she died about 1935.
Oh, 35. You were still in college then, yes.
34. Yeah. And she had several $100 in stocks that we sort of set aside, and we inherited that.
You remember what the stock was?
AT&T.
Good one. You should have held on to it.
I know. But we needed it. Probably would have better to invest it.
See, that's, I guess about those days, what was 32. It must have been worth about $15 a share back then.
It wasn't a lot.
Maybe $20.
I lost money in the bank. I had $33 left in my bank account, and the bank's closed down, which I lost. Eventually got back a few dollars on it.
Yeah, that was in 32. Yeah. 32 is the bank holiday, or 33, I forget.
33.
I forget, was it still under Hoover or under FDR when the banks closed? So. I remember it very vividly. How many people got hurt?
Yeah, a lot of people.
Yeah.
And in that 2 years, I was working in the AMP 70 hours a week for $10 a week. And other people were out
70 hours for $10.
Yeah. But other people were working in WPA for half a week and getting about the same amount. And wish they were inside like I was.
No, I think the highest you can get in WPA was $15, wasn't it?
For
a 40-hour week.
Yeah. It could have been. I don't know. They were getting about the same, maybe not even as much as I was getting.
Did they have NYA at Maine when you were there?
Yes, they did.
Because there you can earn $15 a month. Did you work under NYA?
I didn't work on that. I had a job working in the chemical storeroom. And I don't remember just how much that paid.
But that also paid your lab fee, didn't it?
But that paid my lab fees.
Which was worth
a little bit of extra money, too. And plus a lot of experience, because I got to make all the solutions and know all sorts of stuff like that, and apparatus.
And that includes a cleaning solution, too.
Yeah, cleaning solution and nitric acid and
which you had to be careful
all
not to
the
spill
other
your glass.
Mixing it up in 12-liter flasks. Yeah, that was a good experience. And so my brother and I went back to school, built our own cottage, bought a piece of land for $75, built our own cottage with my father's help, and lived in that for 2 more years, and graduated together.
Isn't it wonderful? You learned to be a carpenter, huh?
Yeah. And a cook.
in a cup. Now, how about the chemistry teachers and the chemistry professors at the University of Maine? They must have had some influence on you.
They did.
Well,
the organic chemistry wasn't that great. It was good. There was a very enthusiastic organic chemist named Gilliland.
Gilliland, that's a good name. It was Gilliland out on MIT, and not the same person, is it?
No,
not
it was
the
a different
same.
Guy.
Yeah.
Well, I did all the things that were done at that time. I did lots of analytical work, all the wet chemistry that people do and don't do anymore, and no instruments.
That's all we had back those days, wet chemistry.
Yeah, that's right. We fertilizers and ores and all kinds of mineral things.
Well, limestone was the toughest thing.
Yeah.
Especially then you're sending potassium,
right.
And the silica. That taught us patience back those days, doing the silica.
and
the R203, remember that?
Right. Well, when we were about to graduate that last year, the people came around interviewing.
This is for industrial jobs.
For industrial jobs, yeah. And my brother took this job with American Cyanamid. I interviewed two, but I told people I wanted to do research, and they told me, well, with a BS, you don't have much chance to do research, and you probably ought to get an advanced degree. So I talked with the professors, and they agreed to support me if I made applications to schools, and I did that.
Was there one professor in particular who was the most benefit to you?
Well, I think he was. There was the head of the department was named Brian Bartlett.
Say that name again.
Brautlecht. Bartlett.
I don't know.
He was an inorganic physical type chemist, but he was very enthusiastic about the idea of doing advanced study, and then this Gilliland, who was an organic chemist, was also interested, and so they wrote letters of recommendation. And I got several chances and picked Ohio State.
Did you write to the universities, or the professors write to the universities?
I wrote myself. I went to the library and looked up the addresses.
Well, how'd you, why did you decide on Ohio State instead of, say, Harvard? Did you apply at Harvard?
I don't think I tried Harvard. I tried about 15 years ago. I got positive answers from Iowa State and Penn State and Ohio State. I honestly don't know why I chose Ohio State.
Particularly since Whitmore was at...
Whitmore was at Penn State.
That was a terrific name back then.
And whether it had to do with something I knew about the professors or something that somebody in the staff at Maine had said to me, I don't know. Hounshell asked me that same question, and I don't know the answer. So, but I did. I picked Ohio State. And
it was not a matter of tossing a coin heads or tails, it'd be Penn State or Ohio State or Iowa State. Was it University of Iowa or Iowa State? Probably University of Iowa, I guess.
I don't remember.
Was it where Gilman was?
Hmm?
Was it where Gilman was?
Gilman was at Ohio State, yeah.
He was at Iowa.
Iowa. That's right.
Did you
Evans and Broad and Ward and people like that were at Ohio State, and Whitmore was at Penn State.
Now, there was no question about you were going to go to graduate school for organic and not for physical chemistry, or not for inorganic chemistry, not for analytical chemistry.
I decided by then I wanted to do organic, and I think the reason was that there was a lot of interest in vitamins and things of that sort about that time. It was sort of a glamorous time, some of it was a little bit before that, but...
But then you had a leaning towards the natural product side.
Natural products, I think, yes.
And also maybe, did you have any leanings towards the medicinal or pharmaceutical side?
Well, I was interested in medicinal things. I remember I got a book from Gauntlet. Gave me a book on chemistry and medicine. It wasn't a very good book, but it was a book that I read and probably had some influence.
You know what? There still is not a good book on that subject.
Huh?
There still is not a good book on that subject, chemistry and medicine.
No. I don't know if there is a good book.
I don't know of any.
But I had read other things like Paul de Kruth's book on microbe hunters and Iron Man and all that. And so some of those things had influence. The organic chemistry at Maine was very, there wasn't very much, and so I hadn't really learned a lot there.
And you're pretty weak on the mechanistic side of organic chemistry, I guess.
Gilliland was interested in, he was interested in Grignard reagents and zinc alkyls. And
I'm really surprised I didn't go to Penn State.
I know.
Because Whitmore was a great one on Grignard reagents.
Yeah, he was.
He worked out the mechanism beautifully on that. So.
Back to Gilliland was also interested in sodium hydrides and things like that. And in fact, I tried to make that sort of thing for him, but didn't succeed very well.
Sort of dangerous too, wasn't it?
It was really dangerous, and I scared everybody in the laboratory because we did it out on the open bench.
not in a hood. Did you have hoods?
Hoods, but they weren't much good.
Particularly not in the in general chemistry. We used the hydrogen sulfide.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm surprised that many of us lived through that course. Because the amount of hydrogen sulfide in the atmosphere is way beyond the hazardous limit.
Well, people passed out from it once in a while.
Was there anything in college you didn't like, any courses you took? Was there any course in college that you took that you did not like?
I took a course in business law. The economics course. I didn't do very well, and I suppose maybe that's why I didn't like it. That's why I didn't do well. It required quite a bit of memory, and it didn't seem to have much. It was beyond what I was interested in at the time. I did fairly well in mathematics up through calculus.
Did you take differential?
But I tried a course of differential equations, and I didn't really finish it for credit.
Oh.
And that was about as far as I got.
Did you use the Korn book for differential equations?
I don't remember the author.
Real thin book.
There was a little thin book then.
She was a mathematics professor at Johns Hopkins.
I see.
That's the one I had at Penn State. I thought it was a perfect little book. Anyway, I'm sorry. It was Mrs. Korn who taught me the course. Her brother wrote the course. I forget his first name. She was the teacher I had then. Now, Maine was a land-grant college. That means that you took ROTC.
I took ROTC for 2 years.
How'd you feel about that?
It was something to do.
Did you enjoy it, or did you find it distasteful?
I kind of enjoyed it. It has a kind of a discipline, and I didn't mind that.
How'd you do in marksmanship?
Very good, because I'd already gotten a marksmanship merit badge in the scouts, and I had a rifle of my own and enjoyed that.
And you had a 22 probably then.
You had a 22, that's right. And the rifles that they had, although they were heavier, had 22 barrels on them.
Yeah, we did too at Penn State.
And I had to take the regular PT phys ed programs, which I did for a while, and then I also did fencing, which was a kind of an interesting thing to do too.
So it's courses like physics and physical chemistry really did not bite you like chemistry did.
Physical chemistry was okay. I didn't.
You used Gutman Daniels back those days.
I did all right on that, and but I guess it didn't send me.
not like organic chemistry.
Like organic.
I'm surprised you didn't go for analytical, since you did so much work in the storeroom.
Well,
also,
yeah, I liked work. Analytical, and I did. You know, that was over a long lab period. You had to work Saturdays and to get in enough time and get your analyses done. But I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It must be completely different today, don't you think? All the instruments.
Yes, it's hard to imagine what it's like today. There's all the instruments that you can have.
Don't you think analytical chemistry really taught us chemistry? The wet chemistry really taught us chemistry that you do not get with instruments?
I feel it was important. It was a kind of a discipline that made you do things carefully and properly.
And also retouched the chemicals, too.
Yeah, and you knew what the chemicals were and what they looked like and what they were made of. Yeah.
And what they smelled like.
It was very important, and I'm a little concerned that, although I'm not acquainted enough with college courses today, that people are so far from chemistry they won't know what chemicals are like. Mm-hmm. Because that turns up in some of these stories that you see in magazines once in a while. I think that's why this program you have in the schools is good, because students get a chance to see chemicals and work with them.
Every chemical I bring into the classroom, I take out the kitchen.
Yeah, well, that's true. You have to be safe.
Well, not only that, chemicals they know, like baking soda,
which
vinegar,
they understand, yeah.
Lemon juice.
Sure.
So then I give them litmus paper, and then they go home and redo all the experiments again.
Yeah.
With their parents. And I think they're teaching their parents something too.
Yes.
What's an acid and what's a base. When we went to Ohio State, now, of course, when the first year you were there, you had an assistantship?
I had an assistantship, yeah. That was the basis for going to any of these places, was to get an assistantship.
And that paid you about $500 or $750 a year?
$450
then. Yeah, it was very. Yeah, that's right. You had to have a scholarship to get up to $750, and that's like a fellowship, like a DuPont fellowship,
well,
or something like that. Yeah.
The next grade up in the assistantship program was $750, I think. I didn't get that.
Your assistantship was in analytical or inorganic or in general or what?
It was in general chemistry. We taught the freshman students, and we had both. Well, in the beginning, we had lab classes. And later on, we had quiz classes too. Of course, Ohio State was a big school with lots of pre-med students and nurses and all the general students taking the first year of chemistry.
And even the metallurgists took 1 year of chemistry, I think, didn't they?
Yeah.
Engineers,
large number,
mechanical engineers, electrical engineers.
All the engineers. Required to take basic chemistry.
So your lab courses had at least 100 or 200 people in them, huh?
Oh, very large.
And there were three or four or five of the people like you monitoring the experiments. Now, when did you have to choose your professor at Ohio State?
The second year. During the first year, you run around and interview the different professors to see what programs they had and whether they would take on students or not. And so I did that. I talked with all the organic professors, and they were William Lloyd Evans and Wallace Broad. He was in spectroscopy, and Ward was in hydrocarbons, and Wolfram was in carbohydrates also, along with Evans.
Didn't Ward also do some work in the cellulosics and the carbohydrates still?
Not at the time I was.
Oh, not yet.
No. Broad was working on dyes and dye structure.
Is it more like a physical chemist or more like...
Yeah, he was a physical chemist. And he was actually working on a UV spectrometer before Carey came out. And he had this student working this out on a big table. I did experiments in that area where you did one wavelength, one thing at a time. But they were working on a machine that would do the whole scan. And then Hennig was there. Hennig was working on the fluorocarbons.
Mm-hmm. And he got a coupon from
you? I received a consultant with DuPont. You may have seen him in Delaware.
I don't know whether he did or not.
That's H-E-N-N-Y. And you're talking about
H-E-N-N-E.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. H-E-N-N-E, yes. Yeah.
And Newman was starting. He became one of the outstanding organic chemists. He was just starting as an instructor. And so he was working on straight organic chemistry, synthesis and mechanisms.
And continue that way.
And it continues.
Okay, I think we're on the air again.
Okay.
And we're talking about your professor.
Lasseter was another professor who was new, and he was working on physical organic.
Mm-hmm.
So I went around and interviewed most of these people and ended up choosing Wolfram because he had this program on Osage orange pigments, and that was going in the direction that I sort of gotten interested in plant chemistry and organic combined. Evans wanted me to work for him very much, but I didn't want to do carbohydrates.
But you did. But you did eventually.
I did, yes.
Yeah, that's fate. That's fate for you, isn't it?
Things change the way you don't expect. But I worked 3 years on the pigment, no, 2 years on the plant pigment. And then I got, I couldn't find a job, and that was in 1940. And,
wait a minute, that's right. Well, you were still in graduate school in 1940, weren't you?
You didn't get
your PhD
in
42, wasn't it?
In the spring of 1940.
Oh, yeah.
And then I couldn't find a job. Went all over.
What'd you do? Write a lot of letters?
Wrote a lot of letters.
Including DuPont?
Yeah, I interviewed DuPont.
And that,
all sorts of places. And,
was 1940 was not a good year, we recall, wasn't it?
Doesn't seem to be.
even though the war broke out in Europe.
Shortly after.
Yeah, it was going on in Europe by then, yeah. So Wolfram had this cellulose fellowship, which was sponsored by DuPont, actually, and the person who was on it had been on it 1 year, and there was one more year to go, and so I took that over and had it for a year.
So that was your postdoc at Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
And what did they pay you for that on the postdoc?
I got $2,000.
Not too bad.
No, it was really good after.
Well, you can say the starting salary for PhDs are $3,000 back then.
That was in the range of PhD salary.
Mm-hmm.
I was married by then. I'd been married for a year.
Where did you meet your wife? At Ohio State?
No, she was from Thomaston, Maine.
Oh.
And
So when you were back in summertime, that's when you're recording her then, huh?
That's right.
And Christmas time and all the holidays.
That's right. When I could get back. And
was she in college then?
She was working there in Thomaston as a housekeeper and with a family and getting board and room to pay. And, we got married when I was in my last year. And we went out there and hired a resident apartment.
And this is 1940?
It was 1939.
Oh.
So 39, 40. And then 40-41 we were
there. Then she moved to Columbus while you were a postdoc. How did she like Columbus when she first moved there? It was a shock to her.
It wasn't too bad, but it was a dirty city at that time because everybody burnt off coal. But it's a fairly mild climate.
Oh, well, it's not as mild as Delaware.
Oh, no. No,
it's mild compared to Maine, is what
it's
you're saying.
It's mild compared to Maine. But,
most places in the country.
And Columbus was a big city, but it was not as big as it is today, like all cities.
Yeah.
Yeah. She used to walk up to the lab every night and stay up there until I got through about 11 o'clock at night.
And you started at what time in the morning?
I was up there every morning. Certainly by 8 o'clock.
And a long day then, huh?
Yeah.
You were still a graduate student and you were married in 39. So you're still in the laboratory from 8 to 11, and as a postdoc, you're still from 8 to 11?
Yeah.
It's a matter of a habit, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
Now, you couldn't do this in Buffalo when you went to Buffalo for DuPont.
Well, that was vacation compared to
When you went to DuPont, could you work more than 8 hours a day if you wanted to? You could experimental stuff.
You weren't supposed to because of safety reasons. And I did go in on Saturdays some when we had special projects going.
Didn't you have to work Saturdays when you first went
to
DuPont?
Well, in the beginning we did, yes, that's right.
Until 1945, the way I recall.
And when I first went there, they were working Saturday morning. And then when
Tell me about your reactions to your colleagues at Ohio State, the fellow students, fellow graduate students, and also your professors. What were your reactions to them?
My reactions to them?
Yeah. Particularly at first. coming from Maine.
I got along very well with nearly all the professors. I guess some of the people in the freshman area I didn't care for too much.
You're talking about the people you had to be an assistant to, you mean?
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about the students and the...
Quill and I didn't get along too well. I know you knew.
Now, he was the professor for the general chemistry.
Yeah. he was professor he was inorganic and in general chemistry at
I spell Quill.
Q-U-I-L-L.
Just like it sounds, okay.
Just like it sounds. And he was a military type, ran things with a high degree of discipline.
When he lectured, did you have to sit in the lecture tail? Or is that just one of the assistants sat in the lecture?
Well, we did some. Evans did some lecturing.
For general chemistry.
Yeah.
Oh, so they did separate the lecturing from the laboratory.
Yeah.
The professors did.
And, yes, we had to sit in there. There were a large number of assistants. I suppose there must have been, my guess, without knowing for sure, there might have been 50 assistants. And they had an assistant in charge, and he had an assistant. So it was a very highly organized teaching staff.
This is the way Quill organized it, or this is the way that all the professors organized it?
Well, yeah, it was organized under Quill. Quill?
Who was head of the Department of Ohio State then, the Chemistry Department?
Evans. Mac had been, and Evans was the head. Then.
And Evans was for the several years ago in graduate school.
Yes.
Did he influence you at all, Evans?
Not a lot. I liked him and got along well with him, but we didn't have a lot of contact.
Did he talk chemistry with you?
What?
Did he talk chemistry with you, or was it always business?
No, other business mostly. Didn't talk much chemistry with you. The teachers, I'm trying to think who I had. I had Johnson in thermodynamics and Cornelius in inorganic. Cornelius is still at Kent State as a adjunct professor or something.
Yeah. And he and I are on the nomenclature committee together.
Yeah.
He's a consultant, so am I, in nomenclature.
He was a real dynamic type of person and had inorganic chemistry very well organized. I learned a lot from him. I had board and organic. I did take some, I had analytical organic. And
who'd you take that under?
That was under board, but it was taught by an assistant whose name I don't remember.
Oh. Well, how about your colleagues or the other graduate students? Any of them very close friends with you?
Well, I roomed with a fellow named Blomquist, who later came to DuPont. He was a physical chemist, and Robert Griffith, who went with Eastman Kodak, he was a physical chemist. Who else? I worked with Stan, colleagues in the research area were Stan Gregory. He worked for DuPont and then for Weyerhaeuser. A fellow named Wiest, who went with DuPont and Orkamp.
Quite a few of you went with DuPont then, huh?
A lot of went. DuPont hired a lot of people. But they went to different departments.
It seemed to me one or two of them came to Hercules, too, from Ohio State.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I can't picture who might be at that period, though.
I knew Buckingham, who was in, he's in Wilmington now. He worked down in Baltimore for DuPont. I guess that's in pigments.
McLeod and Frank Moody, who used to live in this neighborhood, was at Ohio State. And
were most of your friends, for instance, the year you entered Ohio State, were most of your friends the first year graduate students, or were they, or was it more democratic and you were friends with the second, third, and fourth year graduate students and postdocs?
Well, yeah, I didn't get to know many students or many people who were not in the graduate school and who were in chemistry at some time or other. I think that's generally true. I knew some people because I roomed with them.
And also you shared laboratories with some, I assume, didn't you?
Yeah.
For your thesis work?
Well, I had a laboratory with Sean Mahan, and Mahan went with he went with Phillips Petroleum, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he went with another company. I'm trying to remember what it was. And Lee Benton was another lab partner. He went into teaching at a small school in Illinois.
Did you have a desire to be a professor? As you were approaching your PhD, end of your PhD? Or during it?
I didn't consider that.
But that was a bad year, isn't it?
It was a bad year to get a job anywhere.
Protecting the university, there was. They were trying to recruit us for the armed forces back in 1940, weren't they?
Yes, there was some of that.
I guess that began.
We weren't in the war until that fall.
Yeah.
But they
were recruiting us. We had to go before a board and get a number and that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. We had that.
Were you close to being drafted at any time?
Yes. I got deferred. We had a number of students. In fact, we had some student assistants in the labs, in the research lab. And some of them were suspect. I just remember that rather vaguely.
But
I know they were investigated as to whether they were...
These were seniors in the college, then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were being paid by the government somehow as assistants. And there was some kind of a paid arrangement. But they were being investigated as to their political background and stuff like that.
Oh boy.
And we had trouble of that sort. We had trouble getting them deferred. Of course, I was up late 20s, and as soon as I went to DuPont began to get a 1A, not a 1A, but a diploma. While I was at DuPont, after the war, of course, the programs began to change, research programs. But gasoline short. I went to Maine on a 2-week vacation, and my draft board was in.
Was in Maine. Oh.
Somebody saw me. I immediately got changed to 1A, and the company had to fight to get me to 3rd again.
Yeah, that happened to quite a few of us, to be kind of from small towns.
Yeah,
we were at a big city university, and but our draft board was in a small town.
Yeah,
that was a real headache. Now, how did you decide on your thesis? Did Mel Wolfram decide on your thesis, or did you decide that it's going to be Osage, or did he decide that? Or he convinced you that this is what you
should work on. He convinced me that this is a good program. He had this program on Osage Orange Pigments. It was already going And he had two other, he had two other students on it already. And one of them was Bill Hess, and Hess came to DuPont too. He worked in the personnel department. And
that's not very close to a pigment, Osage pigment, is it?
No. I had accepted the fact I'd work on the Osage Honest pigments, and because he assigned what part of the of that program that we would do. This was still back in the times when you hit everything with a sledgehammer and in order to analyze. And
you did all your analytical work too, I assume, didn't you?
We did a lot of it. We didn't do carbon hydrogen.
Or did someone else do that for you?
Jim, we sent it to Germany.
Oh.
Wolfram didn't trust American analysts.
Oh, no, but, well, I was in grad school the same time you were, but we had to do our own carbon hydrogen.
Oh, I see. Well,
and
we...
And nitrogens. You did your own nitrogens? You didn't have any nitrogen compounds. Yes, you did, too.
Yeah.
And you had some nitrogen compounds.
We did our own nitrogens and... acetyls and
did you do it by the macro analysis or the semi-micro?
Semi-micro.
But not your carbon hydrogens.
So we didn't do carbon hydrogens. And later on, there was a chemist funded there at Ohio State who did them, and he became reliable in Wolfram's eyes.
Who paid for the carbon hydrogen analysis, you or the university?
It was the university. It was paid out of research funds that somebody had. Wolfram had access to, I guess.
Yeah. He and Brody had quite a few of them.
Yeah. And but he was, well, he'd become convinced that this is the way to do it. When he didn't send them there, he sent them to some other American laboratories that did carbon hydrogen.
And then your PhD thesis was on the Osage Orange pigment then? Or when did you get to the isoflavones? Was that your postdoc?
That's what these... that's what these pigments turned out to be.
Yeah, I know. But first you had to determine the composition.
Oh, yes. All right.
But wasn't that your thesis, the determination of the composition of Osage Orange pigment? Which is an isoflavone, I know.
That's what it was. Yeah.
Then you did research on isoflavones as a chemical, as an entity by itself.
Well, we did do some work on that, but mostly only as a practice to understand how
the pigment works,
how they differed from the Osage Orange pigments themselves.
So actually, you didn't. You went through reactions of the isoflavones, I think.
Yeah. So we looked up a lot of chemistry on natural pigments and how to characterize them.
So you had to read a lot of German for that project.
Yes, we had to read a lot of German, that's right.
And of course you had your nose in Baustein every week too.
Yes. And we were reading Rolfstetter and all the other guys.
Yeah.
Area and
beautiful publications. Beautiful publications.
So we got to appreciate that, and they did work on very small quantities, and of course that's what this whole program had to be worked out on, fairly small quantities, but not micro quantities.
No, still, there's only semi micro back those days.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Now, how about the gluconates? When did you get to those? Was that your postdoc?
In the what?
The gluconates.
Yeah, that was in the postdoc.
That was your postdoc. How about cellulose? When did you hit cellulose?
Well, the cellulose was in the postdoc. we were trying to...
And this was the Water Soluble Cellulose Express?
It was Water Soluble. Wolfram had a program on heparin, and he wanted to work on cellulose sulfate and other cellulose derivatives.
Well, how did he go from heparin to cellulose to the Water Soluble Cellulose?
Well,
there's no relationship there.
It never did have much relationship, I guess. He just thought it might.
But that's a mistake he made.
Yeah, that's right. I don't even know why we were working on the gluconates, except he had some idea that it was going to make a super explosive or something by nitrating some of these things.
Was this the sugar part or the what part did he want to nitrate?
It wasn't
the gluconate itself he wanted to nitrate, is it?
We made a gluconated cellulose and he wanted to nitrate that.
Then he nitrates the cellulose, the hydroxyl groups in the cellulose.
Yeah.
Did the nitric acid, sulfuric acid mixture eat up the gluconate? Didn't it destroy the gluconate?
Well, I guess it did. We didn't get very far with that.
If you're going to nitrate cellulose, you have to...
have to dissolve it in
there. You have to have a lot of nitro groups, of course, in explosive grade.
Well, that's true. We didn't get very far.
You didn't get that far, okay. But anyway, it got you into the literature. I noticed you have a publication, a survey of the literature, you say. Yes. That must have been one hell of a lot of reading.
It was. Literature, there were some 300 references I ended up with at the time.
At least, yes.
And I was, some of them I was translating and all that.
You're translating for Wolfram or for yourself?
I had to write an abstract of each article.
Well, since you were at Ohio State, did you ever have any relationship with chemical abstracts?
Yes, I got to be an abstractor.
And what year?
For them.
You knew Jay Crane then very well.
Yeah, huh? E.J. Crane, yeah.
What year did you become an abstractor?
I was abstracting while I was at Ohio State, and then after I left for a number of years, back when they had individual abstractors.
Yeah.
And they had a long list of people that were doing the abstracting.
I just wonder who was there first, you or me. That's why I'm asking.
This was 19.
You were there first.
40.
Before you got your PhD, so you beat me to it then. I think Crane recruited me, I think, in 45.
I see. Yeah, so it was a little bit before then. I don't remember when I stopped.
And did you have a specific field when he recruited you, or is it just organic chemistry or physical chemistry or what?
I was doing organic chemistry mostly, and a fair amount of cellulose, but also...
And that would be a separate section from the organic.
I think partly I was picking up all the chemistry they didn't have anybody to do, because I was doing French and German, which is tough, and that's a tough way to make any money on it. They didn't make any money anyway.
I asked them to give me only French and German.
Uh-huh.
But they started sending me a bunch of English patents.
I see.
And I revolted against them. I said, look, I can read English very, very well. It's a French and German I want to be expert at.
That's right.
Well, that's very interesting.
That was kind of fun, but... time-consuming.
When you went to DuPont in 1942, is that right? When you joined DuPont in Buffalo, what year? What year did you go to DuPont in Buffalo?
Yeah, Chach was the laboratory director, and he came out recruiting.
You joined DuPont in 1941. Now, you were in the fibers department, I assume.
Yes, it was called the rayon department.
Rayon department, then. and what was your first assignment in Buffalo?
Well, I worked on cellulose. As I said, the first thing he asked for was 2 pounds of cellulose sulfate. But actually, I was working on cellulose acetate and hydroxyethyl cellulose. They had a program on...
This was in a research laboratory.
Yeah, in a research...
It had nothing to do with the plant at all.
Oh, no. This is the pioneering research laboratory's beginning. It eventually became the pioneering research lab at the experimental station.
Did you know Will Smith up there in W.W. Smith? When he was in Buffalo?
There was a Smith in the patent division.
Well, eventually, but first he was in the laboratory.
I didn't know him in the lab. I knew him.
He got his PhD from Yale. He got his PhD, I think, in 29. He's older, much older than the other one. Yeah. He's still alive, by the way, but just barely.
Yeah, I see. I haven't seen him for long.
I saw him. Last time I saw him was the funeral for his wife. And how about Carmen Conrad? Did you know him at Buffalo?
I knew him later, but I didn't know him up there.
And maybe he wasn't there in the early 40s.
There were people like Quigg and...
Q-U-I-G-G. I know that name.
There was a whole bunch of guys that didn't stay.
A lot of famous DuPont chemists were up there then.
Well, Emmett Izzard was there. He worked on... I went to work for him. And
you mean you're saying Izzard or Izzard?
Izzard.
I-Z-A-R-D.
And he's the fellow who developed the...
You had some publications with them, I think, or some patents with them.
Yeah.
Publications and patents, or both.
And patents. He was on cellulose and vinyl polymers, and then he was on the polyethylene terephthalate, and he did the original work for DuPont on polyethylene terephthalate before we learned about ICI.
Well, what do you think about the fact that the English beat the DuPonters of the on the terephthalate?
I didn't understand it.
Well, the terephthalate that was discovered and patented in England.
Oh, yeah.
And this small company, the ICI, ate up eventually.
Yeah.
I think it ate up for the terephthalate.
Yeah, Calico Quintus was in there, and Cortal. And, they got the early patents. And DuPont got licenses under the patents.
And became the number one producer in the United States.
Yeah. And then DuPont actually produced the fiber here in this country before ICI got going.
And that's because of the research they did on the 6-6 nylon.
Yeah.
They had a good basis for developing another fiber.
Yeah.
Because I don't think ICI had really done anything on that. After DuPont did.
Yeah, that's right.
But a very strong end now, though, in fiber production. So who was your first boss at Buffalo at DuPont? Who was your first boss?
That was Emmett Izzard.
Izzard.
Yeah. And
he was a good man to work with and work for.
He was great. He had been a
brilliant chemist.
He was a good organic chemist, and he had worked at the experimental station before he went up there on organic chemistry, plasticizers, and things like that.
How did DuPont feel about publications back in the 41, 42, 43, 44 period?
Well, there wasn't much going on.
Back then, didn't they discourage publications?
On the whole, I think they did.
You have no publications at all from DuPont at that period.
Because
then you have to go in the 1950s, I think, don't you, for your publications?
Well, I got one. I had one 40.
About 48, but that's Water Soluble Gums. That was your book review. And after that, I don't think Oklahoma. That's 46, he has ethers and esters. The chemical companies didn't mind publishing on the analytical procedures, but they didn't like the...
And the one that...
With the Izzard.
All of these have work is done at Nausea 51. Yeah, I came down to Wilmington in 50.
I have it here.
1950.
You transferred to experimental station. Yes.
And these are on work that was done in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. That was done in Buffalo. That's not, all of these are in Buffalo. But
was there much problem clearing these papers in DuPont for publication?
Well, there wasn't.
Of course, not the analytical part. I know they were pretty free on that.
They didn't undergo the kind of review that they do today. They went through the laboratory people, and then they went to W.W. Smith. And I guess...
He was in patents back as far back as that. W.W.
Yeah, he was in patents back at all that time. And
sure, I should know that. I knew. I first met Will Smith in 1948 or 47. Mm-hmm. He was in patents then, yes.
Yeah. They may have been shown to some other people, but it wasn't a very formal review. Other than going to the patent division.
Not like it is today, then.
Chach was interested in publications, but I think the inspiration for this hadn't come primarily from the chemists, and it's almost always been that way.
Then you really had a desire to publish your results.
Yes, that's right.
How do you account for the fact that so few of us do publish? Is it laziness to write? Or is it that they have nothing to say?
Well, there's two things, or at least two things. one is laziness.
Because writing is
hard. It takes a certain amount of get up and go to do that, and an interest. But the chemist is discouraged from it
in
a number of ways. One is nobody's saying, we want you to publish very often. Sometimes you do. But it doesn't get him very much either. He sees it as not getting him any more pay. It doesn't get him any credit within the company much.
But it puts him down the history of chemistry.
Yeah, it does. So he has to want that. He has to see that as a
goal. But don't you think most of the good chemists have that desire to go down in history as being a good chemist?
I don't see that. I don't understand it. I don't see it in the chemist.
But you had it.
Yeah. And I had some colleagues who had that too.
Should I turn this off?
There's somebody in the back.
Oh. Okay, we're on the air again.
Well, the thing we were talking about was publications, and I guess I'm talking primarily from my own experience in the laboratory, but most chemists don't see that they're going to gain advancement or more pay from publication. Now, I agree with you that sure they're going to get to go to meetings if they want to. It's a crutch for doing that. But they're also, the other side of this too, is that they're discouraged from publications by the review process. They go over all the work of writing it, and then people knock it down, say it isn't good enough, say it's faulty, and they have to review it.
Right. Or to reveal so much information to your competitors.
Yeah. Oh, so they get called on that, and on, and the process of review within the company is so extensive that it's just very discouraging, and they give up after a few tries. And it's only a selected few that push and push and keep on trying. Out of 100 chemists that
that were in the lab where I worked, and probably only half a dozen or so have publications. Or,
well, that's pretty high for the total, for the percentage of people, total chemists who publish.
Yeah.
You're talking about 6-7%.
I suppose so.
It's about 1-2% of us are
published. Is that
right?
I had never
for any of our PhD thesis, we all publish our PhD thesis.
Yeah.
Now, when did you become involved in polymer chemistry? And the cellulose, I know it's a
polymer.
You're not going
to call it the
cellulose. No, I'm talking about the synthetic polymers now.
When I got promoted to research associate, that was back in 1945 or 6, somewhere in there. That publication on that's one of the first things that came out of that.
That's the dicarboxylic acid and esters containing the phosphine oxide group.
Yeah, I started as a research associate. I started a program on polymers with phosphorus links.
What really came out of that?
What came out of that?
Yes.
Nothing.
I knew the answer, that's why I asked the question.
Well, at that time
But it was interesting chemistry, wasn't it?
It was interesting chemistry, and we had the idea that changing linkages might change the properties of the polymers, but if you only put a small amount in, they get buried in there, and they're no different than carbon. And we had programs on putting in sulfur and silicon and phosphorus and so on.
Well, of course, there again, if you after you made the polymer and reacted these things further, you could have cross-linked.
Well, that's another possibility of cross-linking.
You didn't go that far, though, back those days.
Not those days. Not with that one. The thing that I missed in there. You always look back and see what you missed was the polyphosphazines. I worked on them for a while, but never got very far. And now we have Alcock with his great program in that area. And it was there.
You're talking about the Alcott of Penn State?
Yeah. But, it's one of those things that you could have discovered if you'd done the right thing.
I imagine you have a lot of instances like that in your career where...
Yeah, you do. You end up with all kinds of things like that.
I can say the same thing.
Yeah, including, yeah.
Well, then, when did you get into the interfacial conversation?
Well, that didn't come until we were down here in Wilmington, and that's 1951. I did that nylon hooked experiment in early 1951.
Oh, you didn't publish until late 1950,
so. Oh yeah, it came out. We talked at the Gordon Conference in 1957.
That was the first announcement of it, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then we talked in Chicago ACS, and publications came out in 59.
Yeah. For which you got the Delaware Section Best Paper Award.
Right.
You and Stephen Kwolek. Is that how you pronounce it? Kwolek?
Kwolek, yeah.
Kwolek. K-W-O-L-E-K.
Right.
This is for the typist so they can transcribe it properly. Now, Stephanie was your laboratory partner almost from the very beginning, wasn't she?
Yeah, she had worked for other chemists, but
she was up there in Buffalo the same time you were.
Yeah, but she hadn't worked for me up there.
When you were transferred.
When I transferred down here.
But she transferred the same time you were transferred?
Yes, that's right.
And then was she assigned to you then?
About that time she went to work with me. And yeah, she worked with me for 25 years.
Yeah, I know. And actually, now what? When she first worked for you, what sort of chemist was she? She was basically a BS chemist.
She was a research chemist.
She was a research chemist when she was assigned to you.
Yes.
and she eventually became a research associate.
And because your father became a senior research associate, though. Your final time as a senior research associate. Yeah. Well, what sort of impression did she make on you when she was first assigned to you? Did you know she was a hotshot chemist from the word go, or were you the professor that made her a hotshot chemist?
Well, I suppose some of the things rubbed off, but one never knows. She was a very careful, meticulous experimenter. She had worked for Izzard in Buffalo.
Oh, so he taught her a great deal, didn't he?
And, but that was when I was a research associate, I guess. I was away from Izzard by then and on my own, and she was working for him, and she also worked for Emerson Whitbacker for a while. She's a smart chemist, and
she do a lot of reading and studying during this period.
She does. Yeah, she reads the literature carefully and searches it carefully.
Did you use her for doing your literature searching, helping you in your own literature searching, or did you do your own? Did you do your own literature searching, or did you assign a lot to her?
Well, we worked in the same laboratory a lot of it, most of the time.
But she always reported to you, though, didn't she? You were always her boss.
Yeah, I was her boss working in the lab on the other side. I made a special effort not to be leaning over her shoulder. That's a hard on a person. Yeah. So we got along very well. And she had separate assignments, although frequently we worked on programs that were very close, where she had one part of it and I had the other part, that kind of thing. And they were programs that were side by side. And other times she had programs that were quite different from what I was doing. And,
did she ever get a patent with only her name on it, or was all her patents with your name? I'm talking as long as you were at the experimental station.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
She has patents in her name alone.
Patents
while she was, while she was still reporting to you.
That's right.
Yeah. So you were running a race. Who had the most patents?
No, she's got quite a few though. She's probably got more than.
She got an awful lot of with your name first.
She's got more than most of the chemists in the laboratory. They've got a display in the hall in the laboratory of people's pictures now. They didn't have it then. And then under them are the patents that they have.
How about publications? Do they have that for publications too?
No, they don't have publications up there.
Publications are secondary in industry, huh?
They have another display on another area that has some of the awards that we've won. And I'm in there, and she is, and some other people. But that's a separate thing. Well, you see, they're not paying as much attention to publications they are to patents. Well, there's a peculiar thing about patents, of course, and that is you have to keep notebooks and keep records. And
well, you do it for publications, too, don't you?
And what?
You do it for publications, too. I mean, your publications are based on your records, too.
Mm-hmm. What I'm leading up to is that the inventor publication authorship can be rather different than inventorship.
That's right, because then no one has to look at your records for the publication, they do for the patents.
Well, patents, it's got to be the records, and you've got to be the first, and you've got to have a concept, and you've got to do some to practice, and you've got to be the first one. And
have you ever lost a patent because you did not record the idea at the right time? That's a tough one.
It's kind of a tough one, but
I'm sure it happened.
Right,
but just like the Ruthers on his Terra Phthalate.
I've lost them by not doing, I have not lost them fast by not recording them, but by not taking that thought
and working on it
and working on it and
within
doing an experiment
within a year of the
and
thought.
Writing a letter or a note or something to somebody else, even though I had somebody witness the notebook, that's not enough always. And
reduction of practice is the
you have to practice it somehow.
That's where you lost out in some patterns, reduction of practice. Tell me about your philosophical views on life and on science in general.
Oh boy. I think career in science has been very rewarding. One, in terms of having work that you enjoy to do
and get paid for it.
Get paid reasonably well. I think that's one of the things that most people who've been in science and had a good career would say. It has its frustrations. Being an industrial chemist, at least, in terms of freedom to do things.
You mean were things you wish you could have researched that DuPont would not let you research?
Well, you have, an industrial chemist usually has to do. He's got to be doing something for the company. He has to do his assignment as best he can. But in the kind of position that I had, you can do that, and then you can do. In fact, you're encouraged to do additional things that might lead to new programs. And that's.
That certainly happened with you with the interfacial condensation conversation. You discovered that. Whatever led you to that concept? I'm still curious, what were the two immiscible liquids you liked best of all?
Well, we weren't as safety conscious as we are today.
So what was your diamine in?
The diamine was in water, and
which had as a hydrochloride,
and the acid chloride was in carbon tetrachloride.
Now, was your diamine as a hydrochloride, or was it just as a diamine?
No, it was as a free base.
As a free base. Did you rather work with the same hydroxide, or you rather work with the excess diamine to observe the release of the hydrochloric acid?
We were using sodium hydroxide.
You referred that to the excess of diamine. Oh.
We had already been stirring these systems as an emulsion. We were adding detergent thinking that it was necessary to get lots of surface. And
why is it better to use two immiscible solvents than to dump your diamine and your diacid into carbon tet or some other good solvent?
That doesn't work. You get a reaction, but the polymer precipitates so rapidly.
The polymer is
low polymer. It doesn't go to high polymer. And this isn't universal truth, but it's true for that particular system.
Did you ever try it in a dry state with any solvent, the diamine and the dicarboxylic acid?
Yes.
What was wrong with that?
There are some systems, for example, tetrahydrofluorocarbon chloride, which is a solid, and a diamine such as a piperazine that you can grind together and they'll polymerize fairly well.
Now this is under heating, with some heating.
Well, either the force of the grinding gives you enough heat to start the reaction, then the heat's evolved and it keeps going.
This is with or without a catalyst? This is without a catalyst, or with a catalyst?
That's without a catalyst. This is a very vigorous reaction. In fact, that's one of the reasons for using solvents, is to moderate the reaction and absorb the heat.
Well, if you use the acid chlorides, how'd you get rid of the hydrochloric acid?
You get hydrochloric acid?
I'm talking about when you did the grinding then.
Oh, yeah,
is it the heat evolve the...
evolve some hydrogen chloride, but
you add a little water
also
there?
Will combine with the amine, and it'll make an amine salt.
So you add excess diamine then?
And you have to add excess diamine.
Yeah.
And the piperazine systems as a type that will work with 2 moles of diamine and 1 mole of acid chloride. Hexamethylene diamine won't do that. It's a rather peculiar, maybe almost a unique system where you can do this 2-to-1 ratio. Well,
you must have tried this with a lot of different combinations, and
we followed that.
Was this by your own ideas or just by assignment from your superior?
Well, the program of making polymers by combining acid chlorides and diamines was already started by Whitbacker. He was making polyurethanes, and the rest of us organic chemists in the group saw right away that, and he did too, that this could be applied to a lot of different polymer classes, and so we divided up the field into amides and esters and urethanes and sulfonamides and so on. And I took on the mechanism aspect of the program.
Of the 3 or 4 different...
So we had a group working on different aspects. And so that's why I did this experiment.
What did you react your isocyanates with?
With diamines and
always a diamine and nothing else with an active hydrogen.
Well, eventually we did it with Whitbacker's work was with bisphosphonates and not isocyanates. Although we did do some work with isocyanates and hexamethylene diamine and hexamethylene.
Now you did that in solution with the.
We did that in. We were doing it 2 phases, and later on we did it in solution.
Because
you don't have to have a salt or a base.
With the urethanes, could you pull that out of the 2-phase system?
No, not very many of them.
Now I noticed most of your publications are on 5-11. Why'd you choose 5-11 so much for your publications? For your interfacial kind of session? 5-11 polyamide.
6-6 is what
we. It must be 6. I thought most.
So 6-10.
I'm sorry, 6-10, not 5-11. 6-10. I'm sorry. You're right. I don't know why I said 5-11. It's 6-10. Yes.
Yeah.
Why'd you choose 6-10? Is that the easiest to pull out of the?
That's an easier acid chloride to handle. It's easier to purify, and it doesn't deteriorate as rapidly. It's just easier to handle.
And that's better for demonstrations to do.
It is better for demonstrations because the solution stands up longer.
Yeah.
No practical.
and they were always with the water and the carbon tetrachloride for your 2 phases.
In the beginning, we investigated a lot of solvents.
Tell me this, Paul, when you did it for the elementary grades, what did this mean to the kids? Was it just a matter of magic to them?
It's mostly a matter of magic, but they...
How'd you give them comprehension with that?
We tried to tell them what we were doing. We told them that the material that we were making was a nylon, and it was similar to regular nylon in its characteristics and these fundamental characteristics. And then, well, we actually tried to explain to them what a parallel was.
Did you put the formulas on the board for the kids?
Yes, we
might be Greg, you really don't know these people.
I'm sure they didn't understand it.
If they know H2O, that's a lot for them.
Yeah, I know. That's right. Well, I had a little experiment that I also showed them, which had magnets in it, and that's one of those publications where you have a piece of balsa wood and two biomagnets with the two south poles pointing out, and then another one with the two north poles pointing out. So, and you make a whole bunch of these, and then you put them together, and they come out of a chain. White, black, white, black. And tell them these things react with each other, but not with themselves.
I suppose you had used the north-south, what would happen?
You
used repulsion instead of attraction for your chain.
On orientation, and you could mark them that way.
So we have also worked with the attraction as well as repulsion, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
But in your demonstration, you preferred the repulsion as against the attraction.
Yeah, well, that's the one that I made up. I drew a diagram of the other kind. But we didn't ever make the models for that.
Oh, I see.
But we have pop beads and things like that to try to give them the idea of following a chain.
Actually, most of your fame rests on the interfacial condensation, doesn't it?
A lot of it does.
Even though
some of it has to do since then with association with Kevlar and his high tenacity fibers.
Maybe you better tell the tape recorder what Kevlar is. Why don't you tell the tape recorder what Kevlar is?
Yes. Well, the Kevlar is an aromatic a fiber made from aromatic polyamide, which is very high tenacity and high modulus. And it's used in...
You use the terephthalamide?
Yeah, it's a polyphenylene terephthalamide. Mm-hmm. And it's used in... fibers for reinforcing plastics and rubber, such as rubber tires and hoses, and used in...
So it's not used in tires anymore like it used to be?
No, not to the extent of it. No, it's used mostly in reinforcing plastics.
When the styrene butadiene came out, it just couldn't meet the price. Kevlar.
No, it doesn't meet that price. It's quite a bit.
So Kevlar is responsible for your fame as much as the interfacial compensation?
It's been the basis for some of the awards, or some combination of that.
Your first award, though, was the first major.
Awards were interfacial, yeah.
And that was the Palmer Division's Palmer Award in 1976.
Right.
This year, the ACS was 100 years old, so you were at the New York meeting.
Right.
Did you read the book, The ACS History?
Yes.
Do you have a copy of it?
Yes, I have a copy of it somewhere.
You've never read it from cover to cover, then?
No, I don't think so.
Of course, I have many times.
I
wrote it.
Yeah, that's right. That would do it. Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about the present day chemistry and present day education for chemistry?
Well, I had first hand experience with chemists for 10 years in the sense of working with them and sensing their education. But those that I trained a lot of chemists the last few years that I was working with the company. I was the person who broke them in and got them indoctrinated in polymer chemistry and weaned them away from organic.
Was they
pure
beaten?
Organic or whatever
was,
they were
was
looking
for?
One of the people you trained?
Who?
Dave.
Deacon. D-A-T-O-N.
No.
Because he ended up as a, in the fluorine part of the DuPont.
He, I think he's in Central Research, at least that's where he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't have him. But I had a lot of others. And most of them were very well trained and adapted very well.
They were real trained in the mechanism part of chemistry.
Yeah. They didn't have, not very many of them had polymer chemistry. And
well, you didn't either until you came to DuPont, really.
No.
Except for cellulosics.
That's right. Sure. That's not entirely necessary.
You know, still only about 20 colleges where you can learn polymer chemistry in the United States out of several thousand. Does that concern you?
Well, I think from a polymer point of view, it's important. That, and the fact that such a large proportion of chemists do eventually work on polymers, that I think that polymer chemistry ought to be part of the curriculum. And so that more schools should be teaching some polymer chemistry, at least basic chemistry.
The University of Delaware does not have a course in polymer chemistry today. They did when Betty Dower was still on the faculty. Since she retired, no more around.
No more.
That doesn't mean the professors don't work in polymer chemistry.
No,
but there is no course in it. You know,
you can't
do chemistry today without polymer chemistry.
No,
particularly not the analytical part of it.
Yeah.
Or the physical chemistry part.
Well, a chemist can't learn everything.
How many children have you had?
Two. We have a daughter and a son.
Are they chemists?
No.
What are they?
Well, his son is a phys ed teacher.
Wow.
And
opposite of his father.
Opposite of his father.
And your daughter?
The daughter, she went to the University of Delaware and studied art. But she's since got married and had three children.
So your grandfather three times over, huh?
Yeah.
Your son's not married?
No. He has been married, but he's divorced now.
Now
he has no children.
Does he net with the high school system or what? As a fit of, is he in the college?
In high school and elementary school, yeah.
Oh, we're here in Westchester?
He's teaching now in the Concordville area. He has taught here in Westchester. Then he also taught in Florida. He was down there for a number of years.
So your son lives with you well?
Yeah, he does.
Where's your daughter live?
Hmm?
Where
she lives over in Willistown, not far away.
Aren't you lucky?
Yeah.
I have a daughter in the state of New York and the state of California.
A lot of traveling to do. Catch up with her.
Only one grandchild, though. Yeah. Well, where do you find your greatest satisfaction now since you've been retired?
Well, I'm doing a number of things. I've been consulting all this time.
Still with DuPont.
Mostly with DuPont. I've consulted with other companies as well. And
you had to get permission from DuPont before you consulted another company?
Not entirely. I do sometimes when the subject is close to their interest. Yeah.
If it's in the polyamides or the
polyesters. I purposely shy away from things like polyesters where I know too much of the proprietary nature and couldn't comfortably consult there. But there are a lot of areas where you can still consult and not have a conflict. And then, I've worked for many years in Boy Scouts, and I'm still working with them. Chairman of a troop committee.
In Westchester here.
In Westchester, yeah. And I collect antique tools, and I've been writing about that. I've been collecting them mostly for the purpose of writing. So I do that, and I belong to a number of societies, and travel to their conventions, and so on.
How about the American Chemical Society?
The American Chemical Society.
Are you going to New York?
Hmm?
Are you going to New York April 13th?
No, I'm writing some chemistry. I've involved two. I've listed a couple of them there. I've got two reviews in Encyclopedia, and we've got another one on azole and vines that's being revised, and it's going into macromolecule.
What sort of azole and vines you're talking about?
These are polymeric. They're aromatic polymers that...
give me a specific molecule for azole and vines.
It's phenylene diamine combined with methyl paraphenylene diamine combined with tithylaldehyde is a prime example. It's all aromatic rings with one methyl.
So the aldehyde reacts with the methyl group to give you your methine. That's what you mean by the
methine.
And then the other end gives you your azole group.
Right.
Well,
it's an N double bond C. So we get that. And those are liquid crystalline, melt-forming liquid crystals. We've made very high tenacity fibers.
And DuPont's not interested in that, are they?
We investigated. It got scaled up quite large scale, and we got a couple of patents on it. But they're not. No, they're not going to make it. We made fibers stronger than Kevlar.
I guess they're not interested, huh?
Well, there are some other problems. There's a hydrolytic stability problem. Of course, they're highly cold, too. That doesn't really matter.
Or if you put them in tires.
No, that's right. Or reinforced plastics. So I'll probably be writing some more chemistry and some more tool articles.
Now, you actually have never been active in the American Chemical Society, the Delaware section or nationally, have you?
Not extremely active. I was chairman of the Palomar Tropical Group.
That's near the beginning of its formation, yeah.
That's right.
That was near the beginning when it was first
started. That was the beginning.
First
few years, I guess.
It goes way back to the late 50s.
That's right. And then I worked with you on nomenclature for a while.
That goes way back to 1950.
Well, later on, I was on the nomenclature committee with Bacallus.
It's the National Science Foundation now, or no, National Academy of Science, I forget. He wrote me a letter 2 weeks ago. I can't remember where he is.
Everybody
says it, or NAS. I think it's National Academy of Science.
He's down there as a program coordinator or something.
That would be Andrew's program coordinator.
Yeah, I think he has charge of the rooms, especially in the polymer area.
Yeah.
And I've been on the awards committee for the years.
Yes. Delaware Commission or the National?
For the National. And for the Palmer Division. Been counselor for the Palmer Division.
But never counselor for the Delaware section.
But no. Done that.
Well, it's too bad. I think we could have used your talents. Okay, I think we can call it quits on this. So I'll come back if this is still going. Yeah. Not much more to go. Well, is there anything we should have covered that I didn't cover? Is it too much chemistry? No. The other interview was on your older part of your life, the chemical side.
Well, we talked a lot about beginnings and
how'd your wife keep busy? You were DuPont doing all your great experimenting with the warmers.
She put up.
Well, how'd she keep busy? Was she involved in church work?
She said the brownie scouts.
Because your daughter, of course.
And she was in the scouts with me. We put on tables for scout leaders, all kinds of stuff like that. She was in on that. She had a lot to do with raising kids.
Naturally.
But we traveled quite a lot.
And this is because you were traveling with the company or because of
Well, I traveled more after I retired than I did before because I could do it on my own.
You mean the work at DuPont didn't force you to do a lot of traveling?
Not very much. And once I retired, I could go to all kinds of meetings. Go to UPAC meeting. I was over Sweden and we teach you polymer chemistry for Ronvi.
That's a good name.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience. I talked in English and they understand it. Very well. So we did that, and I went to Japan. You packed me, traveled around there.
And there had to be an English in Japan.
Mm-hmm. I was chairman of a garden conference, 1924. I went to the garden conference for 3 years.
So you always saw Will Sperling there too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, Sperling used to come.
And I hope to put him on too.
Good.
Because he's... He was real sailor's chemist.
Yes.
Like in the world. He was my first boss at Hercules.
I see. Well, it's no talk to you.
You haven't talked this much chemistry for years, have you?
Yeah, I guess I have, but I haven't talked to that's a thing in the book. I did this interview with Hounshell while there. That's got a fair amount of DuPont proprietary information in it.
That's it. Well, I tried to pull that, of course.
Yeah.
Now, actually, there's not much relationship between the two taping. Yeah. Whether,
no. Other than the beginning, beginnings of why I got a chemistry. different, yeah.
If you had not gotten, if you had gotten into chemistry, what would you have been, a carpenter?
I would have been. I would probably be a mineralogist. Mining and there.
So maybe if you go another college to be with you, might.
I would have done that.
Be a mineralogist today, or metallurgist, or something like that.
Yeah.
Or a mechanical engineer.
Yes. And I've always been interested in mineralogy. In fact, I've given talks at the schools.
Well, do you have a good collection of you have a good
collection? Yeah.
You have a collection of rocks that would demonstrate what the kind of rocks we have in Dole. I look through this sometimes in the elementary.
I think so. I have some Delaware rocks, and I a lot that would be typical. Would be in Delaware. Yeah. I just went down to the Delaware Bowl show that they had in Clayton.
Oh.
Last week.
As a participant?
I belong to a couple mineral societies and I do the geology merit badge for the boys.
How about the chemist merit badge?
I do the chemist merit badge too, but not the scouts want to do that. I've done one textile fibers.
You mean the textile fiber? We're patching out there? Not when you and I were scouts.
No.
In fact, I don't think it was all geology then either, was it?
Well, it used to be the rocks. Rocks and minerals or something, but it was.
Well,
no, it was mining.
Mining, yeah.
Yeah. Bought that, and now it's called geology. That's rather different.
Since coal was a mineral.
Yeah. So. Right. Yeah. Well, if you have some need to talk like that, I'd be glad. Help you with it.
Yeah, I might involve you in the Brickery School for bringing in the talk about geology.
Okay, I have
illustrating the stones.
Box set aside for fossils, because I've got fossils out of the, not out of the Delaware.